Hi, my name's Paul.
And my name is Senorita Reese.
And you're listening to
No Garnish.
Or as you put it, hot garnish.
Hot garnish. It's hot garnish, listeners.
Jesus, we're sweating.
We're sweating in the studio. We can't have any of the fans on because they make too much noise. But the fans in the studio are the only thing that we have as air conditioning. So
I can blow at you.
Oh, you can blow at me any day.
I'll tell you what, I could waft you with my copy of The Gentleman's Companion.
Oh my God, now he's really heating it up. You're going to waft me with your Gentleman Companion?
I am.
Listeners, Paul's Gentleman Companion is his book. So, although I might call mine now The Gentleman Companion.
You're no gentleman.
I'm sorry, listeners.
The reason I have my Gentleman's Companion is because we're drinking a cocktail called the Mexican Firing Squad Special. To give it its full title. These days, it's called the Mexican Firing Squad, but first time in print in this book, it's called the Mexican Firing Squad Special.
Oh, okay. So I like that, though. The Mexican Firing Squad Special.
To give the book its full title, it's The Gentleman's Companion, or Around the World with a Jigger Beacon Flask by Charles Henry Baker.
Ooh. So, like, a beaker is a bit like the Sesame Street character as well, isn't it?
Beaker. Maybe he had, like, a trio of imaginary friends.
Oh, was he called Beaker because he looked like a beaker?
I don't know.
Like a tall tumbler, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he's the scientist's assistant, isn't he?
Oh, and they use beakers as well, don't they?
Yes.
Ah, interesting. Who else uses beakers? Birds, they have beakers, don't they? Their faces.
Children?
Teachers? Artists?
Artists have beakers?
Maybe. Lawyers?
Lawyers?
Yeah. Medical staff?
Lawyers?
Astronauts?
What other professions can you think of?
I snorted. I did my first snort on No Garnish.
The first of today, not the first.
I'm sorry, listeners, I'm not very well. I'm recovering from chest infection and tonsillitis. I was on death's door the other week. 39 degree temperature I was at. On the hottest day of the year so far. It was not very pleasant. I was so delirious. I was walking around in my pants, and I was so delirious at one point that Josh was trying to talk to me, and I was just going, talking in tongues, and he could see my heartbeat through my chest.
Blimey.
It was pumping that hard. And he was, like, timing my breaths because he was just like, my God, because I was really shallow breathing. And he kept on coming in every 10 minutes to check on me to see if I was still alive.
That was nice of him.
It was nice of him, yeah.
I would have left it every half an hour.
I know, it was like every 10 minutes. But yeah, he was kind of poised over the phone because he was really worried. I don't think he'd ever seen me that ill. And then just after I recovered from that, I got a bloody chest infection on bloody Pride weekend, of all things.
Yeah, you've been really poorly, haven't you?
I have been. I've been really ill the last 12 months. And I wonder, like, people out there, have you been ill? Sorry, I paused then as I was thinking. It was the wrong time to pause. Have you been more ill since the pandemic? Because I feel like the last 12 months I've been so ill so many times. And I wonder if, like, you know, as a general thing, have you been more ill than you normally would have been post-pandemic to pre-pandemic? I would like to understand if people are more or less or the same.
What's this going to tell you, do you think?
Well, if people have been more ill, it'll make me think, oh, okay, that's fine.
You're not
alone. If people have been the same or less, then I'll think, well, maybe I've got some underlying health problems.
I think maybe you've got some underlying health problems.
Oh, no, don't say that. I don't want to worry.
I've actually been pretty well since the pandemic.
Oh, shit. Oh, fuck off. Fuck you and your good health.
It's not being around people so much. It's like...
I'm always doing something to make noises, aren't I? Yeah, go on, sorry.
I start talking, you start making noises, and I completely forget what it was I was going to say.
You were saying
that's your tactic, isn't it?
Is that to say that?
You do it every time.
Do I? It's because I've got ADHD. You're doing a podcast with someone with ADHD. That actually isn't being diagnosed. That's been self-diagnosed. But do you know how I self-diagnosed that?
Go on.
Because when I asked the doctor if I could get diagnosed for ADHD,
yeah,
he gave me a really lengthy questionnaire, which I found so boring that I couldn't even do it. And I think that just sums up having
ADHD.
That's
the proof, yeah.
And it wasn't actually all that bad. I did do it eventually with Josh. It was kind of conclusive that he thinks I've got ADHD because I scored really low in the section where it's like this determines if you've got ADHD. I scored very averagely in that. But then the other section, which goes into a bit more detail about maybe your type of ADHD or whatever, I scored very high in that.
Meaning what?
Well, I don't know because I never send it off to the doctors, so I don't know.
Okay. Fucking hell. I thought we've just turned into a medical show.
I know. Should we start the show? Should we rewind and start afresh?
We're going. We're on.
Yeah, but none of that's going to make the...
Yeah, no, it is.
Oh, no!
that's like the peak. We just come down from there.
I always think when we start every episode that I'm not going to talk very much because I haven't got much to say.
Seriously, is that what goes through your brain at the beginning?
Yeah, it does a little bit. I just think, I haven't really got much to talk about.
Like 2 seconds before...
the mic is on.
Yeah.
the lights are on, darling. I'm here. I'm here to entertain. I've missed you all, listeners.
I would say, even when you don't have much to say, you have plenty to say about that. It doesn't stop you.
I love it.
So today we're drinking the Mexican Firing Squad Special. First time in print in The Gentleman's Companion by Charles H. Baker. I'm going to get you to read his little entry.
Oh, I love it. Get to read his entrails.
This is from... So the book is first time in print. In my brain, I've got 1937. Let me just check that. 1939.
Oh, right, okay.
Little background on Charles H. Baker. Get you into character. Charles Henry Baker, he was a copywriter and used to write copy. And that was what actually made his fortune because he was on a cruise... where he was working for the cruise line.
Right.
And he was writing copy for them. And he happened to meet an heiress, a mining fortune heiress.
Right.
Basically, he never had to work again.
Oh.
And he got it made.
Living the dream.
He was living the dream. And he used to travel around the world, him and his mates, maybe his wife, I don't know. He never mentions her.
Yeah.
And used to write these books about the recipes for things that he drank and tasted.
Right.
Like this book, The Gentleman's Companion. There were 2 volumes. One was food recipes.
Right.
And this one was cocktail recipes.
Right.
And it's a really good read. He's got a nice, fun way of describing his little adventures around the world. And for every cocktail recipe, there's a little story about where he picked up this recipe, where he had this cocktail.
Right, okay.
And I'm going to get you to read his account of encountering the Mexican Firing Squad Special.
Okay. Now and again, we found ourselves a little fed up with the rather casual Mexican mixes and the guidance of 2 young Mexican caballeros whose parents mattered in official circles in that city of Mexico. We were herded into fancy, rather dull places, served 2 warm drinks, and finally, on one occasion, we broke off by ourselves, sought out this little bar, ordered things in our own way, then snapped fingers at the consequences.
I really like that last line he puts in there.
Yeah, I do as well.
So basically, Mexican Firing Squad Special is a tequila daisy. I'm talking about daisies before, and I think when we talked about them before, I got them wrong because I said a daisy was a sour that uses a liqueur. It's not actually a daisy. It either uses a liqueur or a fruit syrup, and in this case, it's grenadine. So his recipe is a bit sourer than it's generally made now. So the recipe that I'm going to go by is the kind of more modern one, which is 2 ounces of Blanco tequila, 3/4 ounce of lime juice, 1/2 ounce of grenadine, homemade grenadine, and 2 to 4 dashes of Angostura bitters. And that's it.
You did a little blind taste test, didn't you, between the store-bought and the home grenadine that you made?
Yeah.
And it was interesting, actually. Your home grenadine definitely had more tones, and it felt like it was a bit thicker with flavour.
It's got more depth to it, I think.
More depth to it, yeah, definitely. It's a lovely drink. It's a lovely summery drink. And I think the grenadine as well mixed with the tequila is lovely. It kind of makes it sort of sweet and sour and peppery all at the same time.
Yeah, it's a good description. And it gives sweet, sour and peppery, yeah.
Yeah, and it's sort of nicely spicy as well, but without it being overboard. So it's kind of it's a nice drink because I think tequila is really nice in the summer.
Yeah, it's great.
It really sort of, the heat of tequila kind of mixes in with the heat of the, and I normally prefer, so I was drinking yesterday, I was drinking tequila and orange juice because I really love that.
Mm.
And I had that at the early evening because I think when the sun's coming down, I think tequila mixed in with a cocktail, it just is very synonymous with that kind of temperature, that kind of dusk twilight. That's when I really love it the most.
Yeah, I think it's bang on there.
Do you think so?
I often have that association with tequila.
Do you? Yeah.
It's a good dusky, temperature just starting to drop kind of spirit. Yeah.
Because I don't like it in the middle of the heat because it's too much.
Yeah.
So I think it's a really lovely drink. Yeah.
Good.
And it's interesting to drink it again because as we mentioned, this was in our pilot episode that didn't get aired.
So it's
interesting to drink it again.
So the cocktail bar that he mentions where he drank this.
Right.
La Cucaracha in Mexico City.
La Cucaracha, beady, 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 beady.
He makes it sound like it was a bit of a dive bar.
Right.
Because he says, two respectable gentlemen wouldn't be seen in a place like this.
Yes.
He's not being entirely truthful there. La Cucaracha was quite a famous cocktail bar.
Oh, was it?
I mean, maybe he's being, maybe, I don't know. Like, maybe even though it was a famous cocktail bar, maybe respectable people wouldn't be seen there. Maybe it was too cool for respectable people.
Oh, okay.
Because that's his thing. Him and his companion, whoever that may be, they're being taken around these bars by this pair of caballeros, these sons of Mexican aristocrats, and they're taking them to what he considers really naff places.
Right, right.
So they break off on their own. They go and find La Cucaracha, world-famous cocktail bar. And in fact, we're looking at the cover of their menu here, which has a really nice 1930s illustration of a cockroach in top hat and tails smoking a cigarillo.
So the Cucaracha means the cockroach.
Yes, Cucaracha is a cockroach.
It's a very, jaunty-looking cockroach, isn't it?
So that was my stepping-off point for where we're going to go in this episode. Let's go for the Cucaracha, because it makes me think of the song.
Yeah.
It made you instantly think of the song. So I started researching La Cucaracha, the song. So that's right. Where we're going. We're going to start off looking at this song, La Cucaracha. La Cucaracha, La Cucaracha, ya no puede caminar, porque no tiene, porque le falta la patica principal. La Cucaracha, La Cucaracha, ya no puede caminar, porque no tiene, porque le falta la patica principal. So, La Cucaracha. Everyone knows that song.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. When I was looking up versions of it, it's still a song that's being made now. You can get dance versions, kind of pumping synths. But it's an old Mexican folk song, a corrido, an old Mexican folk ballad, in fact. So originally it was much slower than the modern versions
are. So La Cucaracha, La Cucaracha.
Something like that.
So funny, isn't it? Because to me, La Cucaracha sounds really exotic and La Cucaracha, ooh. But actually they're singing the cockroach. Yes. And it's really funny that, isn't it? How things the translation of things get lost and changed and everything. And you go that sounds so... one of my favourite things is my parents were chatting to a French waiter in Paris and he asked them where they're from. And they're like, we're from Bath. And he was like, Bath, I used to live nearby. I used to live in Cheptain-Malay. And they were like, right. Cheptain-Malay. That's such a lovely way of putting Cheptain-Mallet, isn't it?
Oh, is that what it is? Yeah. Cheptain-Mallet.
He was calling it Cheptain-Malay. And it's just so interesting, isn't it, that how you package something up with language, how it can change the association with it. I mean, I've not been to Cheptain-Mallet, but it definitely doesn't sound as nice as Cheptain-Malay.
No, that's great. So, it's an old Mexican corrido, an old Mexican ballad about a cockroach, and the whole idea of it is that it's a cockroach that's got one leg missing, so it walks funny. So I was trying to find out, how old is this song? How old does it go back? So the earliest written accounts of it are sort of around the late 19th century, 1883. But actually those verses that they found written down around that time were dealing with the Reconquista, which was 700 to 1400 AD.
Oh, what, 700 years?
The Reconquista is a period of 700 years from the 8th century AD to the 15th century AD.
Wow.
Okay. And that's when there's this vying for control of Alhambra, which is kind of the...
Alhambra? Was that Spain?
Spain and Portugal and southern...
And that used to be
up
called...
Up to the Pyrenees.
That used to be called Alhambra.
The Alhambra.
I never knew that.
I was reading about that and how that time period and the Reconquista these days has very sort of right-wing associations. Just that term of historians calling it the Reconquista.
What does that translate to?
The reconquering, the retaking.
Oh, right.
The way that narrative is told by certain folks, it was originally Christian, then the Islamic kingdom took it over, and then the Christians took it back.
Right, I see.
Actually, it's much, much more complicated than that.
Okay.
As most history is.
Yes.
You know? So during that 700-year period, there were like periods of big pushes of Christian and Muslim kingdoms against each other, but then there were periods of harmony of Muslim and Christian kingdoms living together.
Okay. And they were coming from the Moors, which was North Africa, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then the bit from the east as well of Saudi Arabia as well.
Oh, I see. Okay. And then because we covered that in the Espresso Martini episode, didn't we?
Bits of that, yeah.
Yeah, because we were talking about how coffee came in to Italy through Islamic countries, and it was deemed the devil's drink, wasn't it?
Until
one of the popes drank it and was like, this is fantastic. Yes. I'll give it the Christian seal of approval.
Yeah. So potentially, the cucaracha was around much earlier than the 19th century.
Do you see
what I mean? Like, they're trying to find out the roots of it. Well, if there are verses where they're talking about the Reconquista, which was like hundreds of years before this piece of print,
right?
Maybe it was around then. So no one knows. The only way to trace back songs is to find those written accounts of the lyrics and what they were talking about.
So I found
that just interesting in itself, of how you trace a song's history.
So
in the last couple of hundred years, it's much easier to find accounts of La Cucaracha. And it was a song where the melody was used to talk about lots of things. So it was quite big during the Mexican Revolution.
Right.
And all the different factions of the Mexican Revolution, like the Federalists, the Rebels, and even just the everyday folks, they all had versions of La Cucaracha with their own lyrics.
Right.
So some were anti-government, some were anti-rebels, and some were just lamenting the general revolution as it was going on for those 10 years. Also, a couple of things that are linking into that. In Animal Farm, the animals have a revolutionary song.
Right.
It's called The Beast of England, and the tune is a cross between La Cucaracha and Oh My Darling Clementine.
Right.
And if you think about Oh My Darling Clementine, it's actually a really similar tune to La Cucaracha.
All right, I see. Okay.
Oh My Darling, Oh My Darling, Whoa. Oh My Darling Clementine.
Do 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 do.
And that song, that's an old Spanish melody as well. And that was sung by miners during the Californian Gold Rush.
It also sounds a little bit like that song, one of my favourite songs from Robin Hood, the Disney's Robin Hood. Do 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 do. Isn't it?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
And the cockerel sings it, the rooster sings it at the beginning, and he's got like a guitar. And it reminded me of your the tequila that or the cockerel on the tequila that you poured into the
drink. Yeah, we're drinking Red Rooster tequila.
But it's interesting with a lot of folk songs is that they tend to borrow and mix a bit like campfire stories. They get passed down. And if you think about it, like, people didn't have manuscript really. They wouldn't have had written songs. They were just kind of passed down from generation to generation or traveller to traveller.
Yeah.
So you often had these kind of like almost structures of songs that were kind of like borrowed to be able to make your own story for whatever purpose that was. And of course, these songs, these kind of folk songs, were often stories of the time, weren't they, really?
Absolutely.
Kingdoms being taken and reclaimed or lost or whatever, you know.
And a very simple, nice, memorable tune.
Yes, so that they
to hook
be
those words on.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So La Cucaracha particularly gains prominence during the Mexican Revolution, and like I said, used by many different factions in different ways. And one of the ways, it was used in a derogatory way against the soldaderas or adelitas. And the soldaderas are adelitas, and the adelitas is also a name that comes after a song, another corrido. And they were female soldiers in the Mexican Revolution.
Okay.
And so we're going to talk a little bit about soldaderas and the role of women in the Mexican Revolution.
Oh, I like it. Cool.
Oh. The story of the soldaderas is complicated. There were women who chose to fight in the Mexican Revolution.
Right.
But when you say chose, you know, their options were limited.
Right.
Like, all the men had gone off to fight, so there were now villages that were just full of women.
Right.
So they now had no one to defend them.
Right.
So in some cases, you had the women would join up with the army.
And not to interject too much, but when's the time of this? What's the rough time?
Okay, so it's 1910 to 1920. So in some cases, the men joining the rebel forces expected the women to come with them.
Oh, interesting.
Also, the women, sometimes it was a better option than just staying in a village to try and defend the village. It was like, well, we're safer with the army.
Right.
But they played many, many roles in the army.
That's really interesting, isn't it? The kind of the concept of women being in the army, women fighting. You know, I find that such a sort of a modern thing. You know, now we have women in the army, don't we? And a lot of women have fought in the kind of Western world to have their right to be able to be a part of the military force. And not just in, you know, logistics in the kind of the administration of it, but actually to be considered formidable to be on the front line. But actually, when we look through history, women have always played a role in the front line, you know, when it comes down to it as well. And this kind of idea that, you know, when I hear about it, you know, when I hear people sort of saying it now, like, oh, only men should be in fighting and women should be, you know, protected, or they should be in supporting roles and all that sort of stuff. I just think, you know, it's such bollocks, isn't it, really? Because you only have to look through history to see that, you know, women have just as right to be able to defend and to be able to play their part as they want in any role like this. And often they do, and they do it very well.
And because, you know, you had photography around at this time, there are photographs of some of these female soldiers.
Yeah, it's an amazing photograph that you've shown of them all with their bandoliers and their sombreros and
crossed across their chests.
Yeah, it's a very kind of iconic thing when you think about the Mexican fighter.
Yeah.
Is this kind of like cross of bandoliers over them, haven't they? It really reminds me of the film The Three Amigos as well.
Okay.
And it's really interesting that, because, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a comedy. And if you don't know about it, it's a comedy which with Steve Martin, Chevy Chase, and I can never remember the other guy's name. And it was big in the 80s. It was big when I was a kid. And the story about it is three silent movie actors who kind of are out of a job because sound was coming into the movie theatres. So they get kicked out of the movie studio with nothing. Not even their clothes on their back. So they end up stealing their costumes, and they were the Three Amigos, which were kind of like silent movie heroes of the time. They're all dressed up with the sombreros and all of the silver gilded kind of, you know, embellishment on all of their outfits and stuff. And then they end up being called to a town called Santa Poco, where they, because the people there actually think they are heroes, and they're going up against El Guapo, who's the sort of like this bandit who's kind of taken over. And it's set in the 1910s to 1920s, the time of the revolution.
Is that actually when it's set?
That's when it's set.
No, I didn't
realize because it's
that.
It's all about silent movies kind of coming to the end, and then they have to kind of pretend to be, because they're kind of employed by this village to kind of be the heroes, and they kind of have to become them. And it's a very silly comedy. But the interesting thing is that, you know, it looks just like the photo that you've shown me. You know, all the bandits and stuff were dressed like that. And then at the end of the film, they end up getting like the whole village to sort of revolt against the bandit who's sort of taken over. And all the women are dressed up like the Three Amigos, and they all sort of, you know, ride the evil warlord out of their village. So it's kind of very evocative of what you're talking about, because I do remember, yeah, all the women and children sort of, and the old people sort of taking up arms.
Right, right.
So it's kind of interesting, because it's a silly film, it's a silly comedy, but actually I never realized this until you're talking about it, because there is a historical context. And like, for me, it was quite evocative of my childhood, because we went to Spain when I was a kid, and I was quite young, and it was the time the film came out, or like just around that time. And me and my brother and my older sister, we all bought sombreros, and then we were like the three amigos. And my sister, who was the eldest, was Lucky Day. My brother, who was the middle one, was Dusty Bottom. And because I was the youngest, I was Ned Niederlander.
Okay.
And then we were kind of like the three amigos for ages. And it's a really fond childhood memory of mine, you know. And so it's just really funny, like, how it sort of ties in.
Yeah. That's a nice story. Before I get into talking about a few of the very famous Soldaderas, your story about the end of the silent era picture at that time makes me think of a very famous American film director called Raoul Walsh, who started off in the silent movies.
Right.
And at the time of the Mexican Revolution, one of the few big American picture companies at the time, they do a deal with Pancho Villa, one of the revolutionary leaders.
Right.
To make a film of his life.
Right.
Raoul Walsh is going to direct this, and he's also going to play Pancho Villa as a young man.
Right.
So he goes to Mexico, like him and a cameraman and a camera, go to Mexico, join Pancho Villa's army.
Right.
They film some of the fictional scenes.
Yeah.
But for the battles, they actually film the battles.
Wow.
And then sometimes, and this is all in his biography, which is an amazing biography. It spans the whole of Hollywood history. And he says, like, sometimes after the battles where they didn't get some of the action that they wanted, because it's a fucking battle and they're hiding in trenches,
wow,
trying not to get killed.
Oh, my God.
They would get the survivors to dress up as the opposing army.
Oh, my God.
And reenact it.
Oh, my God.
And
God, that's crazy.
Oh, it's insane. The whole story of him doing that is insane. And then at the end, he's paid in like a suitcase full of Mexican dollars.
Right.
And the story is he's got this suitcase full of Mexican dollars that Pancho Villa's given him. They stop at some like border city to cash it up into American dollars before he kind of leaves it all behind.
Right.
And already by that time, when he tries to cash it up, they go, it's worthless.
Right, right.
But the time that you've travelled here, things have changed already, and now that currency is already out of date, and it's literally worthless.
Right, right, right.
So he does it all for nothing.
Really?
Essentially, yeah.
Oh my God.
He doesn't get the money for it.
Because that massive suitcase of cash is actually because of the inflation and all of the currency changes. It's just
And there's
just
a
nothing.
New ruler who's kind of gone, well, that money is no good. Now it's only my dollars.
Right. Bloody hell. Oh, my God.
It's paper. He's got a suitcase full of paper risking his life to make this movie.
That's insane.
One of the saddest things about that is actually that film is lost.
Oh, right,
yeah,
really?
There's no surviving copies of the life
right.
of Pancho Villa. No, it's disappeared to history.
Oh, that's sad, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a few stills out there, and you can go on the internet. You can see Raoul Walsh dressed as a young Pancho Villa. You
right.
can see pictures of him with Pancho Villa.
Right, right.
But the film itself is gone.
So Pancho Villa was, what, one of the leading revolutionaries?
Yeah, yeah.
He was a boxer as well, wasn't he?
Yes, but not that Pancho Villa. There was a later boxer.
There was a later Pancho Villa.
There was
well,
a later
there?
Boxer who was named Pancho Villa after the Mexican
Oh,
Revolution.
I see. Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I've got it mixed up. Okay.
Yeah. But you're right. There was a boxer called Pancho Villa.
But
who was actually quite a famous boxer
yeah.
many years later.
Because there was a cocktail. We did a cocktail on Pancho Villa, didn't we?
Yeah.
And that was that in the Lost Pilot as well?
Yeah, because
yeah.
we did them both.
So, Paul, earlier you mentioned about some of the famous Soldaderas. Can you tell me a bit more about those?
I can tell you a little bit, because not loads is known about them. So, one of them was called Petra Herrera.
Oh, that's a good
and
name.
And she posed as a man to fight on the front lines.
Oh, right.
And she took the name Pedro. She used to get up every morning and pretend to shave her beard at dawn.
Wow, wow.
And she used to hide her braids. So she even had long hair. She kept
right.
the long hair but hid it all.
Right.
And she had a real reputation as a really fearsome soldier. And eventually she ended up commanding a brigade of 200 men.
Oh, my God.
Many of whom...
Wow.
Many of whom were very stunned to find out that she was a woman.
Wow.
Another one was Maria Quinteras de Meras, and she was so highly respected, she ended up outranking her own husband.
That in itself, you know, shows, it proves, doesn't it, that women are just as formidable fighters as men,
oh, yeah.
doesn't it?
We don't even need to say that, do we?
Not- well, I mean, I think we're challenging the status quo, because I still think there is a lot of there's a lot of this still. I mean, I think, you know, women's liberation in this country is improving, but I still think there's a lot of attitudes to think that women aren't as sort of formidable in any fighting positions particularly. So I love the fact that she ended up outranking her husband. You know, that's great. That's a great bit of historical kind of intrigue, isn't it? You know.
It is. Well, this one's even better. Emilio Robles, she assumed a male identity all throughout the Mexican Revolution. And obviously wasn't the only one to do that. But he was the only one to carry on doing that after the Mexican Revolution. And he lived until the age of 95 and died in 1984.
Wow, that's the year I was born.
Was it?
Yeah. Right. God, that's so interesting. I love that. You know, I mean, the trans kind of conversation at the moment is very, very kind of a zeitgeist of our time. It's been bubbling up for several years now, particularly Trump and like Piers Morgan and stuff. They've really sort of fueled this kind of debate. And I think, you know, trans rights and, you know, talking about gender as well, not just sort of being transsexual, but also being, you know, what is gender? What is it to be a man? What is it to be a woman? You know,
yeah.
People are pansexual. They can be gender fluid. They can, you know, and I think it's really interesting, this kind of conversation, because I think it's the future, really, future of civilization, future of what society is, to kind of break down these constructs of what is masculine and what is feminine. Because as a man, men can be incredibly effeminate, and not even and it's kind of assumed that if a man is incredibly effeminate, that they are gay. But there's loads of straight guys who are effeminate and camp and everything, who are completely heterosexual. Just in the same ways that, you know, for a woman to be incredibly masculine, we kind of think of them, oh, they must be a lesbian. But there's loads of like masculine women out there. And I think the idea of, like, you know, sexuality, and I think it's amazing what's happening with the science involved with for transgender people, that they can change their sex, you know, that they can have, you know, hormone replacement. And I think that's only going to progress and get more sophisticated. And how liberating that must be if you've spent your whole life feeling like you're trapped in the wrong sex. You know, it must be so nice to be able to finally have that. And I feel like all the people who want to hold that back and keep people in these kind of binary, like, man-woman constructs, it's so, so frustrating.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. I got no, yeah. But I find that interesting. Why people want to hold that back? What do people fear? What is it they're worried about?
Yeah. And I think there's this idea that it's often men that want to hold this back, but there's lots of women out there who also want to hold these ideas back, and also, yeah, you know, that want men to be men and women to be women and all this sort of idea. You know, it's not just a patriarchy thing.
No, and I kind of see some arguments about fearing for the children and children being pushed into one thing or another, and I don't buy it. I don't buy that.
No, I don't buy it either.
No.
You know, this idea that, I mean, I think, you know, maybe children, if they want to do gender reassignment, maybe should do it at an age when they're older so that they can kind of be sure, because it would be...
Yeah.
A mistake to change or, but I think for the trans people that I know, you know, going through the transition wasn't a light decision. It wasn't just like, oh, actually today I feel like I want to change gender, you know, that's not, or no, change sex. It's been a very, very considered, like, difficult process. You know, you are changing your biomechanics. It's not an easy process.
No, I would say the people who are pro-trans rights are incredibly thoughtful and considerate,
yeah,
as opposed to the people against trans rights.
Well, I mean, Piers Morgan's a great example of, you know, the kind of troglodytes that kind of want to keep it back.
And
I
troglodytes?
Think, well, he kind of is, isn't he? Because his argument is like, well, you know, people want to be called a they now. What? I mean, if I wanted to be considered a dog, can I just be a dog now? And it's like, where have you got that from? Like, I want to be considered a piece of cheese, so I'm going to be now labelled as cheese.
Is that,
you know,
what he actually said?
Something like that. It was something as absurd as that. Like, I want to be a piece of broccoli.
I can certainly imagine Richard Madley saying those things.
Yeah.
And probably.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Piers Morgan as well.
Piers Morgan and Richard Madley are the kind of the same ilk of person, aren't they?
They are. They go out drinking together.
They go out drinking together. It's like Alan Partridge and bloody, like, you know. Yeah. I mean, I love it. Like, there's a game you can play on the internet, which is like, is this Richard Madeley or Alan Partridge? And it's really hard to work out. And there's like a little splicing of all the Alan Partridge things Richard Madeley has said. And it's just like, oh my God, had he actually said that?
I know, it's staggering, isn't it?
There's almost like, there's almost a joke in there, isn't it? Richard Madeley, Piers Morgan and Nigel Farage go in a bar together.
And a piece of cheese.
And a piece of cheese.
All go in a bar together.
No one can
tell the difference.
Yeah, that's it. That's the punchline.
I'm out of facts.
Oh, the Fact Factory is closed for business.
Fact Factory is closed for business. Did you have a favourite fact from today?
My favourite fact for today is the trans fighter.
Emilio Robles.
Mm. And also that the director ended up directing a film about the revolution and actually ended up just becoming a part of the revolution.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just bonkers, isn't it?
It is crazy.
Like, I mean, yeah, taking that to the next level, isn't it? Right. Matters Arising, does that come at the end? Should we do Matters Arising now?
I love it. It sounds so
official, doesn't it?
Official and organised. Yeah. What were you going to say about Pod Bible magazine?
Oh, well, we've got that definitely to talk about.
Yeah. A big thank you to Pod Bible magazine, who've put us in their list of indie podcasts to listen to in their August issue and also named us Indie Pod of the Week.
Yay! I couldn't believe that. I was so happy.
Thank you so much, Pod Bible.
Yeah, thank you so much, Pod Bible. To be listed in that is absolutely fantastic. That's amazing. So thank you so much. And then, and thank you, Paul, wasn't it? Because Paul helped us get into that.
A friend of mine called Paul, yeah.
So, thank you so much. That's brilliant. My Matters Arising is that, leading on from the previous episode when we're talking about heavy metal, the day that the episode came out, I went to see Gwar.
Oh.
And for listeners, if you don't know who Gwar is, they basically dress up in massive monster suits and they play really heavy metal. They're really good. And the USP, the unique selling point of them, is that they spray you with blood, like tons of fake blood. And they're like, you know, I was in the mosh pit loving it. And I was like, this is amazing. I've got videos of me and my mates just going, wah! And just caked in it. And then, but by the last song, I think the last song, they just had to get rid of all the blood bags.
Right.
And literally I was dripping, like soaking wet. And actually I bought a Gwar t-shirt so that I could change.
Right.
But there's something really kind of amazing about all being in a big crowd together, being coated in the same fluid. It really binds you together. I loved it. As you can imagine, listeners. Right.
Bring on the princess, I say.
Princess, are you ready? Just give me a minute, darling. I'm just putting on my lippy. Listeners, welcome. Are you ready for Who Wants to Be a Cocktail? Right, and on this week's episode, as you know, listeners, it always relates to the episode, so if you've been paying attention, you will get the cryptic clues, but only if you've been paying attention. And, as always, I will be giving you a cocktail, which you can name. If you name the cocktail, you get points, and if you name the film that the three cryptic clues are based on, you get bonus points! So, name the cocktail, 10,000 points. Name the film, 10,000 points. Get them both together and you win 50,000 points! And also send them in to nogarnishpod on Instagram or nogarnish@fastmail.fm. So the cocktail is Reposado Tequila, Orange, Serrano, and Fresno Chili. Salt the rim, add the ice, and garnish. Okay? And for the three cryptic clues. Clue number one. When you're out of a job, you can't remain silent. Just make sure you're not mistaken for a hero, or you could end up being silenced permanently. Cryptic clue number two. When it's your lucky day, dust off your bottom. Santa Poco, a thread through a needle. Buddy up your trio of friends, whose only reward is that justice has been done. And cryptic clue number three. When you're gonna make it, gonna make it, gonna make it. Just push on through and fake it until you do. And those are the three cryptic clue listeners. And that is this week's Who Wants to Be a Cocktail? So last week, the film was Wayne's World! Wayne's World! It's excellent! Oh, it's right. Party time! Wayne's World! Foxy! And the cryptic clues were cryptic clue number one. When Saturday Night Party ended up on cable, well, as you may know, Wayne's World started off on Saturday Night Live, and the whole premise of the film is that it's a cable TV show that ends up blowing up, doesn't it? It goes from basement community TV onto proper cable. And the reason why I chose Wayne's World is because the documentary filmmaker that we refer to,
Penelope Spheeris.
She ended up directing Wayne's World.
Of course she did, yeah.
So there's a nice little tie into the episode. And the second cryptic clue, Bohemian Joyride, when you do the Fandango. Well, obviously, Bohemian Rhapsody is the song that they sing in the car, and it's quite a famous scene. And the last one, when a foxy lady knocks you off your rocker, don't take the stairway to heaven. Well, the whole thing is Cassandra is the foxy lady, and every time she appears, it's dum dum dum, and it's like, foxy lady, and then like Garth... No, it's Garth, isn't it? Garth sings it every time he sees the lady that of his dreams, who I think is Kim Basinger from memory.
Is it?
Yeah, Kim Basinger was Honey Horny, which was Garth's like love affair, and she ends up being a bit of a nutcase.
Really? Kim Basinger is in Wayne's World?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, and also, Don't Take the Stairway to Heaven. Well, famously, they go to play Stairway to Heaven in the guitar shop, and the guy says, no, Stairway to Heaven.
Yes.
Because it's like, I think, one of the songs that everyone plays when they try out a guitar.
It's a guitar shop, no.
Yeah.
Don't play
it. Yeah. But it's funny, isn't it, Wayne's World? Because it's sort of one of those comedies, like, it's definitely of, like, my era and my brother's era. And actually, your era as well, to some extent. Or maybe you were out of it.
I was kind of out of heavy metal by then.
Yeah. Well, it's funny with Wayne's World because I think it really coined that era. I think Mike Myers is really good at kind of finding the zeitgeist of the time, but I just don't know if the comedies necessarily stand up to have a longevity because, of course, you know, in the 90s he did Wayne's World, and in the late 90s, 2000s he did Austin Powers, which really kind of coined the whole Britpop era and the kind of British kind of revival of the time. And I think that was why Austin Powers was so successful.
Do you know, I never thought of that. That does make sense. I really never liked the Austin Powers movies.
Well, I guess it's maybe an age thing because I loved them when I was a teenager. I found them hilarious. But I think his comedy relates to teenagers more. I think it's... And I think sophisticated comedies that stand up have a sort of higher level of humour in them so that when you're an adult, when you get older, you can still find them funny. Because I tried to watch Austin Powers recently because I loved it when I was a teenager. I found it hilarious and I just didn't find it funny.
No.
And so I wonder if I watched Wayne's World now, would I still appreciate it?
I'm not a big fan of Mike Myers.
Generally, I really like him, but he's brought out a new comedy that was on Netflix or something, and I tried watching it, and I just thought it was terrible. The only thing that I think he's done that's brilliant is Sarah Married an Ex-Murderer. I love that film.
I saw it at the time, haven't seen it since, can't comment.
you're like a politician.
Yes.
I can't tell you if I've seen it or if I've been near it. No comment.
Okay, so this is the point where I would normally say, let's roll the dice, let's see what we're drinking next week.
Yes, of course.
I know exactly what we're drinking next week.
Ah.
Because it's our anniversary episode.
Boo!
And I have made And our friend Hannah suggested an idea, a cocktail idea for next episode.
Oh, wow.
And so I have been working on this idea and working on these cocktails. And all will be revealed next episode, but you'll be drinking not one, not two, not three, not four. You'll be drinking five.
Five cocktails?
Five very special, all tying into a theme cocktails next
week. Oh, my
week.
God. I'm going to be so drunk.
Yes, we both are, I think.
Should we get takeaway as well? Should we get takeaway to soak up the cocktails? We make a real night of it.
That's a nice idea.
Oh, should we get Chinese takeaway? Get an Indian? Get pizza? Should we get... You have five cocktails and I'll bring five takeaways. Okay. And we'll be dead by the end of it.
Sounds like a party. Excellent.
Excellent! Party on!
Thanks very much to everyone for listening.
Yeah, thank you so much for listening.
Cheers.
Cheers. The world's gone
PC mad.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when it's like questioning what's PC when it's already fucking PC, that's when it annoys me.
Yeah, I don't want to get into this argument.
Well... You're already into the argument. You can't.
I feel like I am. I'm trying to extricate myself from it.
Is it because you don't know the answers?
Hi, my name's Paul.
And my name is Signora Rice. Is that not Ralph?
Clapping my hand to my forehead.
Hot garnish.
Hot garnish.
Hot garnish.
Fucking is, isn't it?
It's really distracting.
It's really
you.
Distracting.
I don't know why they're in the studio. They've never been in here before.
Shh.